You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where our motto is, don't tell us what we can't do. Joining me this trip, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. I'm curious, Daniel, how do they actually celebrate freedom on the 4th in D.C.? That seems like an oxymoron.
Yeah, mostly through an abundance of tourists, so everyone who actually lives in D.C. leaves. I'm absolutely serious. The town is a ghost town of actual D.C. residents or Northern Virginia residents, and it has been refilled two times over with people coming from out of town. So it's actually a good day. Like, I went to go get glasses today because there's no one fucking here who lives here who would want to get glasses. So there was no wait. It's awesome. But other than that, they don't really celebrate it. In fact, there's a lot of ordinances about fireworks and noise. And this is when the police get called the most on people having parties this weekend, et cetera. So
it's like Los Angeles on New Year's, where everyone just disappears.
Yeah, on top of that, at a police state, but yes.
Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. Elliot, I imagine it must be lots of fireworks in front of Cinderella's castle for you this weekend.
Well, actually, I mean, we went with my father to Epcot, and the parks are actually really dead, which really surprised me.
Really?
Yeah, believe it or not, Epcot was really, really empty. And then we went to Magic Kingdom, and it was really, really full. So I don't know. It was a little weird. But yeah, Disney's the place to be for fireworks. So if you have not seen fireworks at Disney World, you need to go and check them out.
Well, Epcot is that international villa. That's why nobody's there right now. Fuck the rest of the world.
No, there is an American pavilion, though.
Oh, is there? I didn't know that.
Yeah,
there is. In fact, when you walk in, straight to the back is a giant Ayn Rand quote.
Yes! Yes, it is.
What's the quote?
Throughout the centuries, hold on, I can even pull it up for you right now because I have a photo of it. Give me one sec.
It's an aspirational quote. It's not. It's one of the quotes that gets quoted by left and right and middle and everyone because it's just sort of aspirational.
It's throughout the centuries, there were men who took first steps down new roads armed with nothing but their own vision.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Let's take steps down new roads with our own vision in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad. Because, kid, there's consequences to what we say and what we do. While you're dancing like an idiot, they're looking up to you.
Here is where we draw the line, gentlemen. And as I told Justin at the quote from First Contact, Star Trek, this is where we draw the line, here and no further.
That's not the fucking quote, dude.
That's not the exact
quote. The line
quote.
Was drawn here and no further.
This far. Okay. No further.
Father.
You broke your little ships.
I missed like two words. Relax. Relax
over there.
That's
iconic.
This is how I feel though, when people say, no, Luke, I am your father. It's like, that was never fucking said in the movies. Okay.
Oh, was it?
Anyway. No, definitely not like that. Anyway. What was I going to say? Oh, the FDA. Of course. See, you got me so riled about Star Wars that I forgot about the government, which I suppose is a good thing. But nonetheless, the FDA is coming after our cookie dough. Yes, indeed. Breaking news, according to Indy Star. Everything fun causes death. Yes, quote, the FDA killjoys have said it is no longer safe to eat raw cookie dough, even if you're using one of those Pinterest recipes that doesn't use raw eggs. In fact, the administration said in a new blog post, it's not safe to eat raw flour in any form, not homemade Play-Doh. Although, why are you eating homemade Play-Doh? Not licking the spoon of brownie batter, cake batter, nothing. Here's the deal. quote, you know that raw eggs can carry salmonella, which is no good, but it turns out that flour can harbor E. coli, which is also nasty. The FDA says dozens have been sickened by the Shiga toxin-producing E. coli O121 after they ate raw flour. Dozens, I tell you, dozens of people have been sickened. So, gentlemen, this isn't an outright ban, by the way. We want to be very clear. The FDA is not banning the eating of raw cookie dough. But my God, it is conceivable in the world that we live in that that is where we could go. And if that's it, fuck free speech. I draw the line at cookie dough. I will take up arms against our own government.
When you mentioned no eating raw Play-Doh, I just pictured, like, a government FBI raid on a preschool.
Indeed. Drop the giant Lego blocks. Put down the Play-Doh. Spit out the glue. You're going to prison, Tykes.
It was that one. His mouth is pink. It was that one.
Oh, children are dumb. This is, so Justin and I had a little conversation about this on our private Welcome to the Midside conversation, Facebook conversation, which is, could the government actually outlaw you from eating something or from consuming something? And well, Justin was sort of taken aback.
Right, because this is the whole thing I always have. Unless they put fucking cameras in your house, they're not going to be able to ever stop you from doing something in your own home. I mean, they would literally have to stop the import of any ingredient of raw cookie dough to get you to stop eating it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree that it would take an absolute police state to cease this activity in its entirety. But my example that I use when people talk about these things is raw milk. It is illegal in the United States to have raw milk. Now, how does the FDA enforce that? Well, if they actually suspect someone of doing this crime, they'll put details on them and try to catch them, and then they will bust down the doors of little farms in the middle of nowhere and carry people out at gunpoint because they are consuming raw milk. So what's to stop the FDA from banning anything they think is dangerous? Nothing except common sense, which we are in a short supply of at the moment. So, yeah, I don't know. This is where I draw the line. Cookie dough is my thing. It's like my favorite dessert of all time.
I think this is hilarious that it's even anti-vegan, because you can't even have vegan cookie dough, you said, right?
That's right. Anything with raw flour.
There's no egg, yeah.
Even yeah. Fucking vegan. I thought veganism was supposed to be healthy for everyone. I thought there was nothing in veganism you could eat that was bad for you.
There's a lot in veganism that could be bad for you.
I'm being facetious.
Or rather, you omit certain things, you know.
Indeed. Here's my thing on this. And this is sort of what the beginning of the article was poking fun at. Everything fun causes death. There is a risk to everything we do in life, ever. Getting up in the morning is risky. It really is. Sleeping too much is risky. Laying in the bed for a long time is risky for many different reasons. Everything has a risk. You should judge that risk by the value you get out of this thing. And if we're talking about, I mean, I couldn't even find numbers on the number of people who consume raw cookie dough, but it must be in the trillions.
I'm one of them. I own it. I admit it. I consume it.
And we're talking about dozens of people being sick. By the way, not killed, just made ill. And maybe the risk is a little bit higher for children under 5, fine. But we're talking dozens of people who get sick. What? Fucking, the chairs in my home, I think, have injured me more than cookie dough. Like, let's just put things in perspective here, FDA.
I have a question. Now that they've said this, are places going to stop selling cookie dough ice cream?
Oh my God, I hope not.
Bite your tongue. Bite your tongue, sir.
Like I said, this is something where you don't have to make it a law to have a pervasive effect. So let's say the FDA starts putting out these announcements, and then fucking Cold Stone, because they don't want to get caught up in some government nonsense, stop selling cookie don't you want some, and any of the sizes, like it, love it, or giant bucket of it. I will be devastated. That will negatively impact my life. So
I still can't get over Ghirardelli's over here at Disney Springs in Orlando. They stopped selling the Gold Rush Sundae because it had peanut butter. And chocolate and peanut butter is just one of the greatest combinations in history.
Wait, why? And because some people are allergic to peanuts, they did that?
That's right.
Why? Was it people who are allergic to peanuts were buying something with peanut butter in it?
No, it was fear of cross-contamination or some nonsense. I don't even fully understand. They did it. They caved to pressure.
That sounds like they caved to a lawsuit. It sounds like they got sued, and they did that to protect themselves against future lawsuits. I mean, that's what this happens, right? So really what happens here is they don't have to ban it. What will happen is eventually somebody will sue Coldstone, and they will use this FDA finding as their backing, to which Coldstone will simply say, oh, to prevent further lawsuits, we will stop selling Cookie Don't You Want Some. Because that's what happens with this, you know, litigious state we have right now, is companies stop doing things because there are people trying to get free money. And the government knows they don't have to pass laws. They can just make decrees that people then use against these companies. It's a de facto ban. De facto rather than de jure? Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes! Look at me with the legalese. Ted Olson, call me.
Which is why the government shouldn't be involved in this stuff, right? The government should have no say about whether or not we're eating cookie dough or not. I don't care. I don't care what the government has to say about this. And they should not say it, because they are, whether they know it or not, they are issuing something that has credibility in a court of law, or has credibility in the minds of businesses who don't want to be in a court of law. They shouldn't be issuing these kinds of decrees at all, period.
They know it. They know it. Don't fucking fool yourself. They know it. They know it.
I know they know it. I'm just giving them some minor benefit of the doubt.
No.
Maybe I should.
It's government. There's one.
Here, look. This deserves the same response that Alex Epstein gave to the Massachusetts Attorney General who wanted his emails, which is fuck off fascists. Hashtag FOF. Fuck off fascists. That's right. Speaking of people who need to fuck off, Danielle Brooks, star of Orange is the New Black.
You could just say anyone on Orange is the New Black.
She was in a Twitter tizzy this week because, are you ready for this? Someone had the audacity, when she was flying first class, one of the gate agents had the audacity to say, you're in first class, lucky you. And this is widely perceived not only by Danielle Brooks, but by the legions of Twitter social justice idiots as wildly racist and offensive. And dozens upon dozens of these internet morons took to the Twitters to show their support for Danielle, to talk about, for instance, the expectation that black women are broke is pervasive. I have perfected the dead eye, you're not worth my time face, says the New Black. Leviticus Jordan says, wow, that's really kind of terrible. Living well is the best revenge, so I hope they keep selling you and seeing you in first class. Lamar Richardson says, the ignorance is real. Does anyone read things or hear things as they are anymore instead of what they want them to be? Anyone?
Oh, I'm sorry. Really, I didn't hear what you said. I was too busy getting offended by your microaggressions against me. You're telling me I'm not allowed to feel what I'm going to feel based upon what you're saying. That's offensive, Daniel.
Yeah, this is a new conversation that comes up all the time on the Adam and Dr. Drew show, which is Dr. Drew will say, well, you know, that's how they feel. It may not be right, but that's the way they feel. And Adam keeps going, well, tell them to stop it. Tell them to stop feeling that way because their feelings are fucking wrong. And I don't have to give in to whatever they feel if their feelings are wrong. They have the wrong feelings. Which is a funny debate on the show. But seriously, this is something that has come up at work recently as we're starting a reading group on the Fountainhead, which is how do you read literature? Like the young people in the office say, well, how do I interpret this? And I say, well, what do you mean? They're like, well, how do we look at it? From what angle are we looking at the book?
Oh, you went right to my wheelhouse. Did you do this to set me off?
Well, this is partially why I bring this up, because this is something we've talked about a couple times on the show and something that makes Justin's head explode.
Ah!
I don't want you to read it with an angle. I don't want you to listen to people with an angle. I want you to take whatever they're giving you, look at the reality of the situation, and input accordingly.
Yes, this is the problem.
Put a screen on it.
Look, I'm going to rant here, okay? This
rant
is the problem.
Starts now.
Yes, this is the problem with how kids have been taught reading comprehension in this country, right? What's the first question you're asked after you read something when you're a kid in this country?
What did you read?
No!
I was asked. That's what I was asking.
Well, that's why you can fucking read. No, the first question they ask is, Ellie, you want to take a guess? What's the first question they ask?
How did it make you feel?
Correct. That is the second question that you should be asked. The first question is, what did you just read? To understand something and have a reaction to something, you must first understand it. But we've made it now that the primary is your feeling. We've jumped a step. We've made a step completely subconscious. So we're not consciously comprehending something. We're not saying, okay, what is this? How do I feel about it? Which, yes, if you're automatizing that step, the feelings will come very quickly, but we've completely bypassed the step of understanding. So just whatever you go backwards now. Whatever emotional reaction you have to something defines what the reality of it is, because you have to say, what am I reacting to make me feel this way? You don't say, what is it about myself that's making me react to it? It's something they said. So she gets offended that someone said that. Lucky you. Well, it must be something they said. It's not something in her. It's not that she's sensitive about this, that she feels insecure about the fact that she grew up poor or something, which I'm willing to bet dollars to donuts, that's what it is. Dollars to raw dough, that's what it is. So rather than look at herself and say, what is it psychologically about me? When I get worried about a girl offending me, I'm not like, oh, that girl looks like a bitch, that's why I'm worried about it. No, I know it's myself because I was treated like shit as I was a kid. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's the same thing with stories. We're taught it on the basic level. This is why when people watch a Zack Snyder movie, they can't understand what it's saying because they just take what they want from it, not what it actually says. They can't understand what Lex Luthor's plan is because they don't understand what he's saying and take it for what he is. Oh, well, he's just a Joker. He makes me angry. Oh, he must just be a Joker ripoff. He must be a Riddler ripoff. It's the same fucking shit. You need to teach people, understand reality, then react to it. Not react, then understand. Yes, it's cyclical.
That's why so many people were talking about Civil War, like it's the greatest thing, because it appeals emotionally. They don't have to judge it, you know, aesthetically. They don't have to look at it and see it for what it is. All the feels are just there. That's why people like Civil War. But a film like Batman versus Superman, where you have to actually think, you have to watch it, and you have to derive your opinions based on what you've watched, people aren't trained to do that. They don't know how to do it. That's why they appeal to Marvel movies, because Marvel movies don't make you have to think. You just have to feel. And they're very good at stoking particular emotions.
Right. And the danger here, what we're seeing demonstrated here, is a huge causal link. This is not correlation is causation. This is causation. This is somebody who works on one of these naturalistic shows taking that perspective to real life. You know, it's not as dangerous in art. It's more dangerous in real life. But this is demonstrating to us how living in that mentality and living in that artistic
vacuum
modality affects real life. Can you imagine going up to somebody and being like, oh, that made me feel a certain way, therefore you're an asshole? In fact, you can imagine that. I'm treated that way, and I will bet you anything, Dan, that your wife, Fiza, is treated that way too. People get hurt by what she says, and they assume what she says is wrong and bad, and they think she's a bad person because of it. Rather than actually listening to what she's saying, they make their own feelings the primary. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The defense mechanism that Fiza has come up with for that is the strong go fuck yourself response, which is, I like it. Yeah.
Well, she can get away with it a lot easier now, especially because she's married. You know, when you got a nice set of tits, you can get away with that. When you're a dude like me and God is hidden, you can't get away with
it. Damn, dude.
Reality on reality's terms, Elliot.
It's true.
She'll be the first one to say it. She'll say, I can say that because I'm a woman.
100%. 100%. Especially because she's married now. So she doesn't need to impress any other guys.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. You know who else doesn't have to impress anyone? Millennials. Not big on impressing people.
I would actually say it's the opposite, that their entire life is lived around impressing other people. But continue.
We're both correct from a different angle here. What we're talking about.
I'm more correct because it's my goddamn show.
Is that how it works?
Yes.
Last month, a Pew
Research report. Welcome to the Midside, where Daniel is always wrong.
I don't think reality agrees with you.
But that's okay. How I feel.
That's how you feel? Well, okay, you fit right into this category then, except you don't, interestingly. So, here we go. Last month, this is from the Washington Post, a Pew Research Center report grabbed a lot of attention for saying that for the first time since 1880, young adults ages 18 to 24 are more likely to live with a parent than in any other arrangement. But a new analysis by Pew shows that the trend isn't being driven primarily, at least, by a common stereotype, that of the recent college grad who hasn't found their first job. In reality, behind the trend are older millennials, particularly those without college degrees, who are living at home in unprecedented numbers. In fact, among 30 to 34-year-olds, 13% are living at home. 25 to 29-year-olds, it's 25%. Then ages 18 to 24, 50%.
Jesus fucking Christ, 50%?
18 to 24-year-olds. Now, that is a lot of people living in college, so there's some understandability there.
Yeah, but. And that's a little bit of a deceptive statistic there, too, because, like, when I was living most of the year at Ithaca, my address was still listed as my parents. My residence was still listed as my parents. So that statistic could be a little misleading, too.
Indeed. It's the 25 to 29-year-old at 25% and the 30 to 34-year-old at 13% that are a little more frightening. But this is a lot of people who are living at home not because they necessarily have to, meaning they did find a job or they have some success, but because either they're unprepared to live on their own, which is the concept we talked about last week of adulting, or they're saving money, or there's even an article that William sent me about men favoring experiences over possessions. So this 31-year-old named Tony, who says, last year I made $130,000. I spent a vast majority of it on experiences, wild, rare, unforgettable experiences. I've tasted more than 170 varieties of wine. I'm finding time to backpack, you know,
oh my God, all this stuff.
But he's living at home with his mom. And his mom, he says, my mom's doing my laundry. You know, she picks up my stuff from the pharmacist and the dry cleaner.
This is whatever. So prevalent in California. So prevalent.
Yeah, so what do we think of this? How is this going to affect, you know, these people moving forward? Is this a good trend? Is it a bad trend? Weigh in.
I mean, it's parasitic, isn't it? I mean, the only way he's able to, for this Tony guy, for example, the only way he's able to live off of all these experiences is because he's got somebody taking care of the day-to-day. This is something I've always said as I became an adult. Like, I don't understand how these fucking people exist. And Daniel, something you always said to me is it's because someone else is taking care of it for them. And what I mean by it is, if you look at the way society is set up, the logistics are so fucking annoying and tedious and difficult that you spend so much time doing these things that I don't understand how every weekend somebody can be going on a quote-unquote new adventure, that they can be going to a new city or spending every weekend at the beach or at the bar. Like, there's every once in a while you got to take a weekend. Or, you know, maybe it's every two weeks out of four, you have to spend the weekend taking care of shit to give you time to do the other things. You know, you got to do laundry. You got to have the upkeep on your house. But when you've got your mother taking care of it for you, you're basically living off of her. She's the one taking care of your survival in order to enable you to do these things. So to me, it's parasitic, isn't it?
That's a good question. Elliot, what do you think?
This doesn't actually bother me too much. I'll be honest with you. Even though, like, I own my house, I do live with my parents, even though the house is in my name.
That's backwards, though, Elliot. It's not the same thing. Yeah. You own the house. Like, you're letting them live with you. You've taken care of it. It's different. And if they're doing things for you, it's because you're letting them live there. Like, it's not the same thing.
No, but what I mean is, if like the example of the guy used, $130,000, you know, if he makes that at his job and he's able to travel, I'm pretty sure he keeps his parents comfortable as well. So there might be some kind of a trade-off in that particular situation, you know, where, you know, yeah, you know, maybe mom is doing the laundry, doing the clothing, but she might be driving a brand new BMW that he bought for her, or that he might be, you know, going on these trips with him as well. So we don't really know what the trade-off is here.
$130,000 isn't... Go ahead.
Well, I'm willing to accept that, except that there's no evidence of it in the article. I agree that it's a potentiality, but there's nothing to suggest that in the article. The article goes in a different direction, which I'll go in a moment after Justin finishes his rant.
And 130 is not that much money. I mean, we see this with the NBA stars who run out of money in 5 years because they buy their parents a house right when they get out, and they buy these cars, and they buy these fancy houses. You can't, you know, go on all these trips and buy BMWs for people to drive. It doesn't work that way. Reality does not work that way, and that's my point. Is this behavior is demonstrating a flouting of reality. It's just, oh, there's no such thing as reality. There are no constraints that I have to live up to. I'm just going to do whatever I want. It doesn't work that way.
It's interesting. So the article that William sent takes a different direction here, which is sort of where I want to take this conversation, which is this sort of dichotomy between I can either live a life of experiences or I can live a life of stuff. And more millennials are choosing to, quote, live a life of experiences, trips, wine, things that only happen once, as opposed to buying a house or a car or having a family, having things. There's a couple questions here. One, is a life of, quote unquote, experiences inherently better, worse, the same, or just different from a life of, quote unquote, stuff? And then two, maybe the one area where we can defend these bros, which is what the article calls them, is that the article argues that choosing a life of experiences over stuff is actually sexist. Because women want more stuff, like shopping and houses and cars, and thus saying that experiences over stuff is better is sexism.
No, I'll tell you this with my insight as the wise gay man on the show. All right. Stuff means something different to a man and to a woman. I mean, to a woman, I think that they view stuff, they view things as a culmination of a process, or as it represents something a little bit different. It's not mere accumulation, I think, for most women. It's not necessarily the stuff, it's what the stuff represents. You know, I have a home, I have a house, I have these things, you know, it represents a certain stature of life. I think for guys, we just kind of like stuff that's cool, stuff that is either functional or just stuff that amuses us. I don't know that we really attach those kind of meanings to things the way that women do. Now, granted, I'm making a sweeping generalization here, and I'm sure we'll get a lot of texts and stuff and emails and tweets and stuff about, oh, that Elliot, he's making such a big generalization. But from empirical observation, I think that stuff is more about what it represents with regards to women as opposed to what it means for men. Men will spend more on experiences. Number one, men tend to bond more over activities and experiences than they do conversation and they do the acquisition of things. I think that that's probably why guys prefer more experiences, because I think that that's a good way for them to bond. I think women probably bond more when they can discuss certain things when they're...
Here's my, not pushback, but my question about that is this something about masculinity in general, or is this something about new masculinity, something that goes along with the rise of the man child, for instance, or the idea that we never have to grow up, we don't have to be adults, we can just be perpetual children, or even that childhood is an inherently better state of being?
I think that, I don't even know if it's either of those things. I think it's more that, you know, I mean, and I'm going to exhibit a little bit of goodwill to, you know, to these bros, but I think that it's more a desire to get more out of life. And I think that when you don't have, and not just men, but people in general, if you don't have the skills to produce it, you try to seek it out by experiencing things. We think, I mean, you have the whole generation of people who they think that the ultimate happiness is an experience that you have to seek out by traveling, by you know, sensorially, not necessarily conceptually, not in terms of what you're able to create out of your life, but a life that's sought out. I think that that's more the drive behind it, because we don't value necessarily the creation of our lives anymore. I think that's part of the reason why I can sympathize with them a little bit, because I think that they really are looking for something in their lives. I think that they're just going about it the wrong way. They're trying to seek it out on experiences, but experiences are fleeting. They're not enough, I think, to keep a person going.
It's, yes, you're 100% correct, and it's exactly what I said at the beginning of this fucking story. It's the same goddamn fucking problem. Stuff versus experiences is a goddamn false dichotomy. Philosophy and action. Thought and action. Concrete and abstract. Mind and body. You need the stuff to survive. The purpose of a house isn't to fucking own a house and be like, hey, look, I own a house. What do you fucking need? Food, water, and shelter. You buy a house to have fucking shelter. What, are you going to be a fucking nomad gypsy your whole life? Just backpacking across the world? Like, you get a car so you can fucking drive to places. You get a job so you can afford shit.
And I mean, here's where I'll push back on Justin a little bit, which is...
Fuck you!
Is the idea of you know, getting a home with a 30-year mortgage in a neighborhood that's nice and residential, is that not necessarily a market-driven thing, but a government-driven thing because of certain subsidies and the way that banking and loans are structured? Do you think more people would be more vagabondish if it was easier to do? I mean, we see the rise of Airbnb, for instance, and some amount of people now traveling sort of indefinitely and not settling down in one place because they can work remotely because of the internet. Friends of mine basically are settling down in a home in Canada for the first time in, what, 3.5 years, 4 years, where they've basically just traveled the world, not as explorers, but just traveled the world because they could, because they didn't have to be nailed down in one place. They could just do that.
Well, what's the key you said there? That they settled down eventually. Look, I agree with you completely about what you just said about market-driven and all this subsidy stuff and everything, and also the cultural pressures of getting a house and a 30-year mortgage and settling down somewhere. If you want to get an apartment and just rent it for a few years and then move somewhere else and get it for a few years, fine. But the point is, stability at some point is necessary. You can't just go around the whole world. If it was more cost effective to do that, most people would do that. But you can't live in a motel every day because at the cheapest, that's $50 a night. Now contrast that with how much rent costs per night. There's a reason. The way you afford that lifestyle of being able to go around the world is by saving up and having the stability. And you can't do that indefinitely because the way the plus minus works, you're going to end up in the minus in the long run. It just doesn't work that way.
But isn't that kind of a callback to like the old American male in the 50s, you know, 40s and 50s? You know, you would move to a town, you'd work there for a while, and then you would move on. Nowadays, you really can't do that. I mean, you have background checks, you have so many things and so much legal red tape, you really can't pick up and go on to another place and work there for a few months and then go on and move on somewhere else, work there for a few months. I'll admit that there's a little bit of a romantic idea to that. The idea that you just go settle for a little bit and then you move on after a while to another area. But the idea being that you're there and you're working there, you know, you sustain yourself. I think that that's kind of a part of the American mythos, that kind of wanderlust, you know, go out there and see the world. So, I mean, I think that unfortunately it's just not really possible in this day and age to do that anymore. So I think that's probably where this is coming from. It's manifesting in this kind of wanderlust, you know, false dichotomy between stuff and adventure, because we really don't have the ability to balance the two anymore. We really don't have the freedom to do that anymore.
No, you want to know where it's coming from? I'm going to tell you where it's coming from, and I'm going to quote Adam Carolla here. Daniel, this is going to sound very familiar to you because this is something he talks about all the time. And I'm going to fold this into an argument I always make. The argument I always make is this comes from our parents' generation, the generation before us, being so successful that most things are provided for by us. So we don't have to face that reality. We've never had to face that reality of being poor and starving on the street. This is what Adam Carolla talks about. When he was young, when he was doing stuff, he had to say, I have to work hard and make a lot of money. Otherwise, I was going to be poor and didn't have what I want. But you can go now, and how much does it cost for a 55-inch TV at Walmart?
Do you want the regular LED or do you want like the super 4K? Because it's like, you know, $429 versus $799.
Right. Okay. Now contrast that to how much that cost back in the day, right?
Or the equivalent, yeah.
Right.
Thousands of dollars.
Right. So with the way society has been set up, you know, with the government and the way our parents were so successful, we don't have to face the reality of everyday survival. So what are we more concerned with? We're more concerned with pulling out our dicks and saying whose dick is bigger and impressing each other, basically. That's what I'm trying to say. They're not doing this because they really want the experiences. Why are they doing this? Because they want a woman to be like, oh my God, he's so well-traveled and so worldly. That's who I want to be with. Oh yeah, but when you go live with him, who are you going to live with? His fucking mother. That's what you want? You want to be with a guy who lives with his mother?
Mass psychologization aside, I do see some amount of your point, and I do think that the people who do the experience stuff second-handedly are never going to be happy. They're going to get fleeting moments of pleasure, but they're never going to be happy in the long term.
Besides someone who their profession, who is the Zack Snyder of wine, the Tom Brady of wine, who the fuck needs to drink 171 different types of wine unless that's what you want to do with your entire life? Own a vineyard, own a winery, and sell that shit. No one. The only reason they do that and write that is because they want to impress other people.
That's not necessarily true. I don't agree with that at all. Right. I think you can legitimately have a hobby of that sort. And even if you are a, you know, a homeowner or someone who is rational, you could have a hobby of that sort.
Okay.
Justin, you and I have grown into a hobby that we could look at just as irrationally as tasting 171 different wines with the collecting of the pop stuff. Like, who needs that many? We don't need that many. It just gives us pleasure. And I think it is a rational value because it's something we're pursuing that we like and we're not fucking. you and I.
Whoa!
So we're getting to that threesome question.
I'll just use the word support because I can't think of the word I want. We're just supporting the pop culture that we like the best, that we want other people to support as well. And you can make that argument for many different things. It just depends on if you're doing that hobby rationally or irrationally, if you're doing it for first-handed purposes or second-handed purposes.
Well, to do it rationally, it's an integration of the two things, right? It's not stuff versus experiences. Ideally, it's stuff that is yielded from experiences. You know, it's one thing to buy a chair or a vase or something for your home, but it's another thing if it was made for you by some artisan person in Italy, and you know you will never, nobody else is going to have that, you know, that particular item, and you take it back home. It's not just what you've acquired, but it's the story that goes with it. So I think ideally they're integrated. It's the stuff and the experiences that accompany the stuff.
Right. And when you're talking about Funko Pops for me, each of the ones I buy represent something that's important to me abstractly, artistically, usually, because they're all a lot of movies and television shows. So in what Elliot's saying, I agree with that. But the point I'm making, let me be more precise with the point I'm making about Tony. It's the combination of elements of the time spent. If that was his main hobby outside of work, I would say, fine, okay, that makes sense. That's something you really care about. But then he's listing all of this other shit as well. How do you fucking have time to do all this shit? I would even put forward the supposition he's not even really doing this shit. He's only even writing a fictional argument to try an article to try and get laid. All of it is saying, look at the impressive shit I do, where no one in reality has any sort of time to do all these things, even if somebody is taking care of their survival logistics. It just doesn't work, and that's what I'm objecting to. I agree with you, Daniel. If it's your, like, number one hobby outside of that, like, the amount of time I spend on Funko Pops, if I did that for something else, yeah, I could do that. But it also means I can't do other things. If I'm watching movies, TV shows, working out, and doing Funko Pops, that's pretty much the limit of my time if I'm also working. But people act like they're doing all of these things, backpacking across Europe and drinking all this wine and, you know, being really into cars. Like, time doesn't work that way. That's my point.
The only added point I'll make to that is that some people have alternative work sort of schedules or environments. You and I have a mutual acquaintance whose wife is a doctor for pediatric oncology. And she has what I consider like an incredible work schedule, which is basically like work 48 hours straight and then get 5 days off. Which is awesome. Like, if I could figure out a way to do that and be a digital media strategist, I absolutely would. But the modern era of jobs, especially if we don't know what, I don't know what kind of job Tony has, but it could be in the tech world. He might have an alternative job, or maybe he only works 2 or 3 days a week. then he has 4 days a week or 5 days a week off. So he might be able to have this kind of nonsense life, but it doesn't
okay,
take
is
away
that
from
the
norm?
Fact
that
is that the norm? And if, no, it, if it isn't the norm, why are we raising it up like it's the norm? That's my point.
The question isn't if it's the norm. The question is if it's the ideal. That was the question I was trying to get at. Is a life of experience is inherently better than a life of quote-unquote stuff? And I think the answer is it's a false dichotomy, which you said earlier, and that it's about a life of values and figuring out what those values are in a rational way and integrating them into your life.
Tony just wants to get laid. That's all it is.
Okay, every 20-something-year-old just wants to get laid. That's what it is. That's all they. That's the reason people become vegans and peaceniks and Democrats.
Shots fired at your coworker.
Minnesota man, moving on. This is another peril of homeownership, by the way. Minnesota man takes to social media to try to stop his neighbor from flying a Nazi flag. There are many things about this story that are weird. So this is from KTLA 5 out of Minnesota. Quote, a man in Minnesota took to social media Thursday in hopes of getting a neighbor to take down a Nazi flag he's been flying in his backyard. The flag has been up since last weekend. Holson lives down the block from the flag's owner's house on Pleasant Street in the suburbs of Lauderdale. I didn't know how local this story was. He described his feeling about the flag as disgust. Quote, I had a hard time sleeping last night. His direct neighbor is Jewish. When they said they were worried and terrified and didn't feel safe in their own home, that's when I got disgusted even worse. So there's a couple things about this. One, I was first excited, actually, about this article, and I was going to talk about how awesome it was that he took to social media to try to get this guy to take the flag down instead of going to the police.
Are you serious?
And it was his second effort. He went to City Hall first to see if there were laws against this. And the police. So I no longer like this guy.
God, you were going to applaud this guy for going to social media to do this shit?
I was going to applaud this guy. If he had not gone to the government, if he had not tried to use force to get this guy to take the flag down, I would have applauded this guy because this is how you would deal with these things in a local situation. Look, this guy in the neighborhood's waving a Nazi flag. I think that's horrible.
I agree, it's awful.
Why don't we not associate with this guy until he takes the flag down or moves out or whatever? That's how you would deal with this in a rational situation.
Except he's not doing it that way. He's not saying, let's not deal with this guy. Let's ostracize him. Let's use peer pressure. He's saying, everyone, this guy has a Nazi flag. Let's go in there and make him take it down. That's the issue.
Well, I don't see anywhere where he says, let's make him take it down.
You think
that's
not his goal?
Other than going to the police part. There's no evidence of that, talking about reading into things. He has no quote that says we're going to march in and make him take the flag down. And he says, I hope he takes it down. Look what that flag stands for.
He stays up at night because he can't sleep at night because this guy's flying a Nazi flag?
Okay, that's ridiculous. You should be able to sleep, even if your neighbor is flying a Nazi flag. Although, let's be serious, especially in the modern era.
Are you fucking kidding? Oh my God! The number of people who do things within my general vicinity that I think are horrific, if I let that keep me up at night, I would never sleep.
It's not just horrific. The guy is flying a flag that is representative of a movement that killed millions of people. And indeed has a resurgence in the United States and in Europe of neo-Nazis attacking people in modern day. So the guy is flying a Nazi flag in the backyard. I mean, that's very different from, say, let's flying the stars and bars, which I think are also offensive. But you don't have lots of hate groups rising up and killing people in the name of the South.
Okay.
At least unless you're maybe in the South.
What about the Mexican flag? What about people who come to this country? And now I'm not saying Mexicans are the same thing as Nazis.
I want to be clear.
Let me be clear. I'm not saying Mexicans are the same thing as Nazis. But what about the fact that there are people who come to this country, never integrate into American society, continue to wave the Mexican flag, and then go back when they're done taking advantage of us? You think that doesn't offend me? You don't think I think that behavior is horrific? Do I let that keep me up at night?
I don't. Even if you are as offended by that, it doesn't pose an existential threat. I don't think it poses a real threat. Because how are they taking advantage of you? There's nothing they're doing to actually take advantage of you.
When we're giving them the same benefits as American citizens, even though they're illegals?
Who's taking advantage of you? The government may be taking advantage of you if that's the case, but the Mexicans are coming here because of the incentives created. They wouldn't be coming here if the incentives weren't created by the government.
That's the same thing
as blaming Walmart for not paying their workers health care because they can get health care from the government and say, Walmart's a welfare queen. We wouldn't be doing it if the incentives weren't there. It's the government that initiated the force. Same thing.
But is Walmart going to fly an anti-government flag then?
Is the Mexican flag an anti-government flag?
It's an anti-American flag.
It is not an anti-American flag, Donald Trump. Come now.
When they're in the same tournament as the American national team and people are born here and they're going to support the Mexican national team over the American national team, it is anti-American at that point. That's when I have a fucking problem.
Justin, come on. That's not the case. You'd have to know in an individual basis by basis if they were being genuinely anti-American. I don't think that's true at all. But let's get back to the Nazi flag, which is radically different. It's not as if the Nazi flag is the flag of any country. It's the flag of a specific time in a country's period when they were killing millions of people. I think it's a vastly different thing. And I applaud this guy for going to social media. I don't applaud him for going to City Hall into the cops. That's beyond the pale. The one part that I do absolutely agree with you on is that I don't know. You have to look at the context of the next door neighbor. I don't think he's like some buff, bald headed white guy. I think he's a guy doing this to just be sort of offensive. So I don't think I wouldn't sleep well at night because I don't think this guy's going to actually do anything.
Yeah, I mean, if he had an oven in his backyard, I would be busting his house down, his wall down, and killing him. You know what I mean? But he's not. He's not killing Jews. He's not actually killing Jews. That's my point.
He's just sanctioning the killing of Jews, but he's not actually killing the Jews.
Yeah, so this is the way I would deal with this is via social media in the neighborhood. Basically, like, we're not going to associate with this guy until one, he takes the flag down, or two, moves out, because it's horrific. But yeah, he doesn't need to lose sleep at night. Like, he needs to focus more on mowing his lawn and going for walks and listening to classical music.
I mean, this is the same thing as the last story to me. This is why I fucking hate social media. This is the problem I have with it. This is a local story that would have stayed local, and these people would have been mad at him locally. But now because we have social media, we got to fucking put this shit globally, nationally, to make people think we have got big dicks. Oh, look at how awesome I am because I fucking hate Nazis. Yeah, I fucking hate Nazis too. I don't need to say shit about a guy living in Minnesota when it's got nothing to do with me. How did we handle this shit before social media? Do you think there wasn't a guy in Minnesota flying a Nazi flag before social media?
I didn't know Minnesota was such a Nazi hotbed.
I don't know.
I wouldn't have guessed Minnesota.
It's because it's so white there with the snow.
St. Olaf, what do you expect?
Shots fired against St. Olaf. Wow.
Oh, St. Olaf, is that the snowman from Frozen?
Yes.
Who is white.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Elliot's more of a Luther College guy, which is why he doesn't like St. Olaf. That's such nerdy college humor. Anyway.
Did you get the point I'm saying about pre-social media?
I am, except that it doesn't bother me in this case because the guy is actually doing something horrible. Or at least, if not horrible, worthy of being ostracized for. Like, if this was a case where the guy was flying, a NASCAR flag, and the neighbor thought, well, that's representative of racism, and thus I put it on social media, that's the kind of story I could get up in arms about. But it's a Nazi flag. I can't get all that excited about defending this guy or the reasons the other guy went to social media. The guy should be ostracized.
I'm not defending any of them. I'm saying they're all fucking retarded and find a hobby is what I'm saying. Go drink 171 different kinds of wines. If the guy's killing Jews or going out there putting signs that say kill Jews, fine. But fucking get a hobby.
What? To be fair, the Nazi flag is kind of a sign that says kill Jews.
Exactly.
To be fair, the Nazi flag says kill everyone who's not us.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, it's
then everybody should be offended.
I mean, your people didn't fare that well either. Just saying.
I understand. That's why I'm saying I'd be the first one busting his door down if he was actually doing shit.
The line is, what is doing shit? Yeah.
I understand there's a line here. I'm just saying, like, if I worried about all the different shit people were doing, like, it's the whole thing, like, fucking, there's a something corporate lyric where it's like, you know, it's basically saying, you know, these people who are like, well, there are starving kids in Africa, so I can never be happy. It's that kind of idea for me. That's the kind of idea I have, is like, my happiness is not dependent upon injustice going on in the world. Like, my neighbor flying a Nazi flag isn't going to make me unhappy.
It'd make me unhappy, I'm not going to lie to you.
I guess I'm an asshole, what can I say?
I was like, oh, yeah.
I mean, my neighbor is more likely to fly an ISIS flag, but...
That's a good question, though. If it were an ISIS flag, it'd be very different.
Unless it was that ISIS flag in the gay pride parade, which was ISIS made out of dildos.
Dildo, like, yes.
That would be, I'd be okay with that ISIS flag. That's funny. That's all just right. Funny right there. Doesn't matter who you are.
All
right,
you want to talk about other stuff?
Finally.
All right, let's talk about other things that are probably going to make me mad in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Focused on. All right, just to prove that I'm not a complete asshole, I saw Finding Dory this week, and unfortunately Dan did not see it. I was kind of hoping he did, because then I would give my review and he would give his review. But in order to keep things spoiler free, because I know Dan's a big Pixar guy, he's a big Finding Nemo guy, I'm gonna keep things pretty general, and I'm gonna give a review of this movie. So much like Finding Nemo, Finding Dory is a road trip movie. It's Dory trying to find her family. She suddenly remembers that she forgot her family and has to figure out where they are. You know, it has a lot of the same elements of Finding Nemo, which makes sense because it's a sequel. But the greatest challenge that this movie faces is it has to make Dory good. And what I mean by that is not benevolent. I mean it has to make her memory loss not a disadvantage, but an advantage. So the movie goes to great lengths to do that. And it succeeds in some ways and it fails in other ways, where I think there should have been something about spontaneity in there and the importance of spontaneity. And they kind of hint at that and talk about that, but they don't really, I don't feel like they executed as well as they could. And I have a similar problem to this that I had with Finding Nemo is, and this is probably perhaps even worse with this one, because, you know, the whole idea is, as I said, making the memory loss a good thing. The problem I have with this is there's a lack of integration where, you know, any road trip movie, it's very tough to make it seem like the things that are happening are integrated along a theme. That's the greatest challenge, I think, in a sequel faces and a road trip movie faces. And I don't think that this movie does that a lot. It uses sort of the idea of family as sort of the integrating theme, but that's not the main theme of the movie. And it shouldn't be when it's about Finding Dory, not Finding Nemo. Finding Nemo is more about family, I think. Right, Daniel?
Yeah, what family means.
Yeah. So they kind of sort of...
Also, I mean, there was another element of Finding Nemo, which is sort of about growing up. And really, I think the thing about Finding Nemo was more along the lines of, like, you know, living your life instead of... What's the... Is it a Rand quote? The run toward life instead of away from death? That sort of thing. That to me was maybe the more prevalent theme of Finding Nemo, but family was a very close second or an equally major theme. So
they sort of had some of these undercurrents as well, undertow as well, and in Finding Dory.
How very droll, sir.
Yeah. Well, that's actually funnier if you've seen the movie. And if you think, I will say this, Daniel, I am very interested when you see the movie, because they completely lost me at the climax. So if you think the climax of Batman versus Superman is absurd, you know, the whole Martha thing, I want to see what you think of the climax of this movie, because the climax of this movie just completely lost me. Like, if Martha is ridiculous, then I don't even know what to say about the climax of this movie. Like... Mm.
Does it feature a trans jellyfish?
No.
Oh. there was a rumor that it was this was there was going to be a trans jellyfish in this movie.
No, there was no jellyfish at all. Maybe they cut it.
Ellen started that rumor, by the way.
Okay, she was probably joking. That sounds like Ellen trolling, is what that sounds like.
It got reported as news.
Wow, the internet reported something as a news that was a joke.
She even named the character. She said he was, it was Stingray. Or, I'm sorry. I said jellyfish. That's my fault. I said jellyfish, and I meant Stingray. That's what I meant.
I mean, there's
a trans Stingray?
There's a Stingray character, and they go on a migration, so they're, going transatlantic.
Oh, no, she said it was Stingray who was transitioning to be Sting Rhonda.
I mean, they might have cut that, because at the end of the movie, he's not there anymore, so it sounds like maybe they cut that out.
Hmm.
It still sounds like she's trolling. I mean, this is like, I was just watching Jim Jefferies' special, and he starts out talking about Bill Cosby raping people, and he's like, yeah, in Australia, they wrote an article saying how this act by mine is offensive because I'm advocating for rape.
Really?
Yeah. And he was just like, that's so retarded. He's like, these are jokes, and I want to be clear that I am in no way advocating rape. No way if you ever think, like, hey, I should go out and rape someone. Oh, yeah, Jim Jefferies supports that. No. It's the same. I think Ellen was just joking. But yeah, so I think the climax of this movie is absolutely fucking ridiculous. Like, it to me, like, once you see it, I'm going to make it a meme. Like, saying something of how absurd it is. That's how bad I think it was. So, ultimately, I will give this movie a 7.5 out of 10.
God, I cannot figure out your rating system.
What do you mean?
Like, you're just all like, it's not that good, it wasn't integrated, and 7.5 out of 10. It's like, what?
Well, the animation is stupendous, the character work is great, and I mean, there were some amusing things in it. It is an above-average movie.
Made a lot of money.
Yeah, well, I mean, there were children. I mean, it was 11 a.m. on a Sunday, and there were children all over the theater, so.
Yeah, so far, worldwide total, $538 million.
Yeah, it's going to do very well. All right, let's take down some trailers. So we've got four trailers here this week that I want to know your guys' opinions on.
Hopefully, trailer takedown!
Yeah, someone make some, someone out there make some music or something. I'm just going to write it on the whiteboard for now while I talk about these. So we have four trailers. One of these was actually submitted by Daniel. He felt very strongly about it. But the first one I want to talk about is Clint Eastwood's next movie. It's starring Tom Hanks, and it's called Sully. It's about the landing of the plane on the Hudson River. What did you guys think of this trailer?
I want to make a meta comment first about all this segment, which is usually my least favorite segment of the show. Sorry, Justin. But it's mostly because I hate movies. I really do. I just hate movies, and it's the rare exception. It's the rare exception that I like any movie, which is why I see so few of them. But this week, I don't know if it's because I was in a good mood because I got new glasses and I could see the world better or something. Like, I liked all of the trailers this week, by the way. I mean, I may have had some qualms with them, but I actually felt genuinely excited about every single one of these.
Interesting. So when we get to the last trailer, I'm going to have a challenge for you then.
Yes, okay. Well, so...
Okay, so why did you like Sully?
Well, I guess Sully...
Let's bust through these pretty quick. Why'd you like it?
Yeah, well, I had the expectation that it was going to be fucking terrible when I watched the trailer, because it's a movie about an old man who landed a plane on the Hudson River and no one died and nothing bad happened.
And then they vilified him for it and said he was drunk.
Well, yeah, but honestly, that part I didn't even hear about that much. So I didn't even know that went on. So when the trailer went through this sort of story of him being vilified for doing this heroic act, I thought, oh, there's actually a compelling narrative here. And Tom Hanks looks awesome as Sully.
Yeah.
That stash.
Isn't it in the trailer where they're like, you were drunk? And he's like, but I saved everyone.
Yes.
No, I had a similar reaction to the trailer where I was like, wow, this is Tom Hanks. It's probably going to be fucking stupid. And I was like, wait, why is this so good? Oh, Clint Eastwood's directing it. That explains it.
Clint Eastwood.
Yes. Elliot, what did you think? Good or bad?
I liked it. I'm probably going to go see it. I love Tom Hanks. And he's ever since he played Walt Disney in Saving Mr. Banks, I've always felt this loyalty to him. So
oh, I thought you were going to say after he played the guy with AIDS in Philadelphia, you felt loyalty towards him.
No, no. Yeah, I mean, because I've always liked him as an actor, but I don't think I ever really felt like it takes a lot for me to feel a certain kind of loyalty to an actor in his work. And I really, after Saving Mr. Banks and seeing how he brought one of my idols to life in that screen, you know, on screen, I've been much more aware of his different roles now. So I'm probably going to go see this. Maybe not opening weekend, but I am going to go watch it.
All right. So this next trailer will save Daniel's reaction for last here. This is the one he submitted. It's starring Bryan Cranston and James Franco, not Dave Franco. I want to be clear about that. And it's a movie about a guy who doesn't understand his daughter. And I'm saying that facetiously because it's called Why Him? Because Bryan Cranston meets his daughter's boyfriend who then wants to propose to the daughter and is basically saying, why him? And it's a comedy about, you know, what goes on between the two of them because they hate each other. And for me, like, I like the cast, but I made the joke I made because it's like, it always seems like this would only happen if the father really didn't understand the daughter. And that seems to be the problem for me with a movie like this. This should really be about the father being like, why don't I understand my daughter? Rather than why him? Although, doesn't James Franco kind of represent Tony, as we were talking about in the news section? Discuss. Elliot?
Yeah, I had pretty much the same reaction you had. It's another typical, you know, father-daughter. Father's having issues with the daughter, doesn't like the daughter's boyfriend, and the hijinks that ensue. Yeah, it didn't really do anything for me, personally.
Daniel?
I typically hate movies. I said this already. And then a subset of movies that I hate more than movies themselves would be comedies. I think most comedies are terrible. Something about the combination of James Franco, Bryan Cranston, and then who's the actress who plays the mom?
Oh, I forgot to say that. Megan Mulhaney.
She's
very
you.
Underrated as a comedic actress. Like, anyone who doesn't know who she is, fucking check out her shit. She was on Will and Grace, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Parks and Rec.
Parks and Rec. And she was on Party Down. Later seasons when Jane Lynch left, they replaced her with Megan Mulhaney. You know, disregard Mulally. Will and Grace.
Mulally.
Yeah. Whatever the fuck her name is. I don't care. She's funny. I'm here advocating for her. Who cares if I can't say her name? Check her out. She's very, very funny. Very funny
she
woman.
Plays
very underrated.
The evil librarian in Parks and Rec. And she is the real life wife of Nick Offerman.
Oh, wow. That's a power couple.
Yeah. But those three, the chemistry on screen between those
God,
three,
that household must
compelling.
Be so funny.
I couldn't even imagine. Like, how do you live on a daily basis?
Yeah.
What was the other thing I was going to say about this? Oh, the other thing I want to say about this is this kind of thing, maybe now because I'm married to Faiza, sort of speaks to me. Like, my family, and I suspect many of my friends, did not quite get my relationship with Faiza for a while.
That's not what I heard at the wedding. At the wedding, everyone was like, we love Faiza from the beginning.
Yeah.
I was the only one who admitted that I, like, didn't get along with her.
They put the entire wedding party on blast right now. Is that what's happening?
Yes, I
am. I loved everyone there. But
Michael Jones?
I think some folks didn't quite get it. But, like, literally, the first thing... So my mother, Faiza and I go home for Thanksgiving. That's when she's meeting my mother and family for the first time. And this is when I was a little bit better on the weight loss side of things. My mother said, wow, Dan, you look good. And the first thing Faiza said to my mother ever was, it must be all the sex we're having.
Yep. Good.
To which my mom was like, oh, hello. I'm Karen.
See, that's the weirdest thing is I never saw that side of Faiza to begin with. It's so weird. Like, that's the side everybody else saw. If I saw that side from the beginning, I would have been like, I love you.
So I don't. So maybe there's just something about this situation of this movie that's particularly compelling for me. But I thought the chemistry of the three main actors and that situation seemed like it's going to be funny. So
yeah, no doubt about the chemistry of the three actors. Like those are great talents. I mean, it's not Dave Franco, but we'll deal with, you know, the Franco we can have. All right, next trailer. Bleed for this. This is starring the controversial Miles Teller, and it's a boxing movie. And I say that because when the trailer first popped up, I was like, another fucking boxing movie? Like, how many goddamn ones can we do? I mean, we just had Creed, right? Which was the, the spinoff of Rocky, starring Michael B. Jordan. So it's sort of like, you know, how many fucking boxing movies can we have? But then as I watched this trailer, I was like, okay, this is a different take on a boxing movie. This looks like it could be pretty good. And what they basically did was, I would say this is Rocky crossed with the King's Speech, is what I would describe this as.
That sounds like a good Hollywood pitch for this movie.
Yeah, I like to think about that when I see trailers or new shows. I think about what was the pitch they gave to get this made.
Yeah, why did I think that the other day? There's a side story there, but let me ask you first. Why did you say the controversial Miles Teller?
Because people really fucking hate him for some reason. I think he's a great actor, but there's all this negativity about him. Like, when he was cast in the Fantastic Four, people were like, oh, he's just a smarmy asshole. He can't really act. It's the same character every time. But I think he's a great fucking actor.
Yes. Hello. Whiplash. And now the trailer for this movie, which I had an even worse reaction. I said, I will never watch another fucking boxing movie. That's what I said when the trailer came up. And then I was like, holy shit, I may watch another boxing movie, although probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks excellent. It looks like it's acted well. And it's, you're right, exactly. It's this overcoming this huge obstacle in this guy's life so that he can get back to doing the thing that he loves.
Yeah.
I think that's a fantastic message. So.
Yeah, I didn't actually get a chance to watch the trailer yet, but I like Miles Teller. I don't know why people don't like him. I think that's weird.
Do you think it might have something to do with
Whiplash being, you know, a more romantic movie, and it's just a byproduct of the culture's attitude against romanticism? Do you think it has something to do with that?
I think it more has to do with the type of character he plays. I think they're confusing smarmy with sort of the rugged individualist. I think he tends to play more ruggedly individualistic characters. If I had to say some sort of artistic or psychological reason, I would say it's that. I mean, look at Whiplash. Yeah. Look at this role. I mean, what kind of character is he playing? People like that in our society, are they more supported, or are they more people try to tear him down?
Right.
I really wanted him to play the young Han Solo, but he didn't get that role.
He doesn't look enough like him is the problem. He could do it.
I know.
But he doesn't look enough. His hair is too dark. He's too big. I picture young Han Solo as skinnier.
Yeah, well, alas. So the reason I had that thought the other day, quick side story, is I was watching the new network show Brain Dead, which is about Washington, D.C.
Yeah, by the people who did The Good Wife.
Don't you get enough of D.C. in your daily life, Daniel? Why do you want to watch shows about it?
I do, but I came to terms with the fact, about 2 years ago, I came to terms with the fact that my favorite genre of television is political drama. Like, I fought that for a very long time, but I just came to terms with it, decided I'm just going to watch everything political.
Yeah.
So I watched this show, and it's, by the way, it's because I have some romanticized view of politics. Like, if it was a rational culture, I think I would want to run for office. I would want to be in politics.
Ugh.
But because it's not, I want to try to fix politics and the culture.
Ugh.
Anyway, I had the thought because while I was watching Brain Dead, which is a shitty show, but it's basically the West Wing, or let's not even give it that. Let's call it the, what was that other shitty political show? Scandal meets Mars Attacks.
The East Wing.
Oh my God.
Because I thought, oh, I guess no one's ever done a political drama mixed with a sci-fi B movie. Like, and that must have been the pitch. So it's terrible, but that's exactly what it is. It's Scandal meets Mars Attacks.
Oh God!
All right, ready to talk about the last trailer?
Yeah,
Elliot. I'm assuming you haven't seen it yet.
No, I couldn't. I could not get the videos to work. I don't know if I just I don't know what's going on, but the other ones were fine. I couldn't get my stupid thing to work for it. So I'll take your cue.
Okay. I'm gonna throw this to Daniel.
Woo.
So this is a movie. It's an animated movie. It's Trolls. It's based on the Troll dolls. And it's starring Anna Kendrick and Justin Timberlake. And I was completely off-put by this trailer.
Really?
There's something to me about the animation that really bothers me. And the best word I can come up with to distinguish that is contrast. And what I mean by it is everything looks the same. There's nothing like... unique about the way it looks. It's like all super oppressively bright. And to me, it makes it so it's not visually interesting at all.
Oppressively bright. Yeah, so I actually had a different emotional reaction to that exact same thing.
So I am identifying something then.
You are, because okay. The style is purposely super bright, a little bit fuzzy. It's very candy-like. Yeah. So you've actually had, if you've had the trolls candy, that's actually what the animation is based on. And there are worms, like the gummy worms and the troll brand, like represented in this and stuff like that. But I actually was very excited because it's stylized in a different way that you don't typically see in animated movies anymore, where the foreground characters are sort of the most important thing and the background is just sort of an almost abstract painting. Not super abstract, but maybe like Monet kind of abstract painting. It doesn't matter. You have the foreground characters and the rest is just sort of supposed to evoke a certain kind of emotion. That's not my favorite style of animation, but I do appreciate that kind of stylization, and this is sort of bringing that back in a certain way. And it looks different from everything else that's out there, and I like that. Additionally, I thought the writing was actually quite good for a DreamWorks film, at least for a trailer. And the end joke had me laughing. Very funny. Very hysterical. The annoying princess character playing the guitar and the sort of downer troll says, may I see that for a moment? And he picks it up and holds it, and then he just swiftly throws it into the fire and then sits down.
Yeah, it was obvious to me he was going to do that.
Okay, shut up, Captain. I read movies. Some people are just trying to experience it as it comes along.
I can't help it, man. That's how my brain works, all right? We'll get to that
shut
in a second.
Off.
Shut off my brain. Fuck off. We'll get to that in a second when we talk about the Ultimate Edition of Batman vs. Superman. But a couple quick stories here. The first is a buy or sell. So I'm going to ask you guys, are you buying or selling this, and give a quick reason. They're going to do a Wreck-It Ralph sequel, and it's going to be in 2018. So are you guys buying this or selling it?
2018? It's forever from now. I thought Wreck-It Ralph was good. I'd be interested in seeing a sequel. It was a little socialist-y at the end. But
yes, so socialist.
I thought it was a fun movie, so buy.
Elliot?
I never even played with troll dolls as a kid, so I don't really know how I feel.
Nope. Moved on to Wreck-It Ralph.
What are you fucking jerking off over there? Like,
Elliot, we moved on to Wreck-It Ralph, the sequel. Oh, playing the sequel for Wreck-It Ralph.
Oh no, I was completely like just thinking about. No, I have no interest in the Wreck-It Ralph sequel because I wasn't crazy about the first one, so I just didn't like it. So yeah. I don't think I would see the sequel.
I thought there were good things about the first one, the use of the video game characters, and if they could get more video game characters, they could convince me to change my mind to a buy, because they said they were going to modernize it. So that could be interesting, depending on what properties they work with. But simply because I found the ending so offensive, where it's just give your time to the man and blah, 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 I can't get excited about this, because I thought the ending was just really bad. So
it's the idea that well, good and evil, they both have a purpose. Like, you know, there's no point to being good without the bad, and that's kind of the vibe that I got from that, you know. And I reacted at the time. I reacted really strongly against it. So that's why it's just not one of it's not one of the best things that Disney has put out, unfortunately.
All right, this next one's for you mainly, Daniel, and I think I know what you're going to say, but James Cameron basically shit on the
sell.
It's not a buy or sell. I just want to know what you think of it.
Oh.
James Cameron shit on The Force Awakens. Yeah, and this is what he said. I have to say that George's group of six films had more innovative visual imagination, and this film was more of a retrenchment to things you had seen before and characters you had seen before, and it took a few baby steps forward with new characters. So for me, the jury's out. I want to see where they go with it. Now, this is interesting to me because we talked a lot on our The Spoilers Awaken episode about how Star Wars is an epic tale that repeats themes and repeats elements. Yet, James Cameron, I guess demonstrating his complete lack of understanding of story, says that that's a bad thing.
Yeah, he automatically disqualified himself from being right by... I mean, other than by making the Avatar movie, by including the three prequels in the six films he talks about with George Lucas, three prequels coming from someone who Star Wars is an enormous part of my life still to this day, and I love it dearly, were some of the shittiest movies ever made. Ever. Just complete and utter garbage. Revenge of the Sith having some redeeming points, but mostly also still garbage. The fact that he includes those in the vision of George Lucas as being creative and original disqualifies him from being correct in this scenario. And even if he was just talking about the originals, yes, he completely misses the point of Star Wars and the Star Wars universe, which is that it is an epic tale, much more like a Greek saga than a modern-day movie with sequels that have to be new and bigger and ramped up and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I actually really adored the way that J.J. Abrams did it. Episode 7. Sorry, had a brain fart there. And thought that it was exactly what the Star Wars universe needed, actually going away from the sort of nonsense explainer movies that George Lucas was making in the prequels and going back to the saga storytelling. James Cameron is a dope who needs to shut up and go dive somewhere in a submarine and leave the rest of us alone.
Well, he'll be
making
lots of
Avatar 2 and 3.
Right. He'll be making lots more avatars, so.
God, no.
And true story, Attack of the Clones was so bad, episode 2, that I still have not seen Revenge of the Sith.
Wow. I mean, not surprising, but wow. By the way, unoriginal, fucking ripped off Fern Gully
yeah. In
his movie, and then also created a fucking mineral called unobtainium.
Yeah.
Go fuck yourself, James Cameron. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah, Avatar was very unoriginal. But let's talk about something that is original. So, as we were waiting for, since the theatrical cut was released, the Ultimate Edition of Batman vs. Superman was released on the 29th. I, for one, got no sleep that night. Well, I got a couple hours of sleep. Because I stayed up and watched it immediately because I could not wait. And I spent the $20 on that, and I will, you know, spend even more money on the Collector's Edition to go right next to my Collector's Edition of Man of Steel. And the surprising thing, sarcasm, is that suddenly the internet has turned in favor of Zack Snyder. He became a meme this past week called Zack Attack, where they photoshopped him showing up at random places attacking people because there was a picture of him with a gun with Ben Affleck, and they took him out of that. And also many people have been saying they're apologizing to Zack Snyder for the response. Why are they saying that? Well, if you remember, Daniel, what was the number one thing I said after I saw the theatrical cut for the third time? What did I say I noticed?
The editor made a boo-boo.
Right.
I butchered the film.
Right. All the scenes I noticed were truncated. Well, look at that. When we watch the Ultimate Edition, all of the transitions are back in the fucking movie. That's what they added back in the Ultimate Edition. Or rather, that's what they took out when they made the theatrical cut. You want to know why the movie was disjointed? You know, originally I said that it was like in the beginning, after the prologue with the two, you know, Bruce Wayne scenes, it was like three different movies. There was the Clark Kent movie, the Bruce Wayne movie, and the Lex Luthor movie. If you accepted that, when they came together, it would make sense. Except now, with the transition in, it's one fucking movie, and you understand why they're jumping from where they are in each point. They're juxtaposing them, and they're showing why they're related.
And they're finding their way to each other too. It's Clark Kent's investigating into the African woman, Kahina. I can't remember her name. But while he's looking for her, that's how he latches on to the Bat Vigilante. It's purposeful. Everything is guided by their choices, by their actions. And I think Justin, you were the one who pointed it out that even though it's billed as Batman versus Superman, it's really Lex versus Lois, because you have one that is orchestrating the deception and the conspiracy. You have the other that is in pursuit of the truth. And in a way, Batman and Superman are almost pawns between the two of them.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that more when we do our full episode on it. But that's definitely truth from a thematic standpoint. Lex versus Lois is as important as Batman versus Superman. And what Elliot's saying is 100% correct. They've actually added more of Clark Kent into this movie, and they've made Lex's plan more obvious and more demonic. And the other thing they've done is the senator's character is much more despisable. Is that a word? Despisable?
Despicable.
Despicable. That's the word I'm looking for. She's much more despicable than she is in the theatrical cut, because there's a drone. And the government's trying to blow up the village in the Africa scene. Superman blows up the drone and then saves Lois from the warlord. So he's beating evil from all these different sides. And then it immediately cuts to the senator going, "Today is a day for truth." And my reaction this time was, fuck you. I literally said that and flipped off the senator, because it's like a day for truth and you're not even going to say you were involved and we're going to kill all the people when you're saying Superman should be held responsible for them dying.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the government look much worse.
And now we understand where she's coming from with that unilateralism, unilateral decision making that she talks about, because it comes up. And I noticed that even in the theatrical run, she uses that word, unilateral decisions, things like that. Why, you know, you shouldn't have in state sponsored or state affairs. And I'm like, what is she talking about? Now you know she's speaking specifically about his decision to render the drone useless. He destroys the drone. So that's what she's referring to when she's talking about unilateral action.
That's way different.
Well, and we also understand why she's a Democrat now too, because this is vintage Democratic rhetoric where, hey, we're the only ones who can do unilateralism. So if somebody else does it, they're bad if they're trying to stop us, but we can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes her look much worse. So
I'm excited about watching it. I haven't had time to devote to sit down to watch the whole thing yet, but the moment I get
sex you're having, God.
Apparently, the moment I get, you know, 19 and a half hours straight free, I will sit down and watch it.
So. 3 hours. It's a half an hour more of footage.
It makes a difference, though. It really, really does. And you hate Lex Luthor, and that guy, the Russian guy, when he, you know, oh man, he's terrible. Like, oh.
Yeah, the henchman gets more time in there too. It's just a much better cut. So this cut of the movie, I would give a 9 out of 10.
Wow,
Elliot.
Wow,
I'd give it a 9.5 out of 10.
Remember, I originally gave it a 7.5 out of 10. So I'm upping it all the way to 9.
Finding Dory.
Yeah. I would say the original theatrical cut was about on par with Finding Dory. Because of the issues of it was disintegrated in the way that there were no transitions or anything. But you add the transitions back in and you add all this extra footage of Lex and Clark and the African woman and Lex's henchmen, and it's just a much better movie.
So you're saying at the climax, Dory screams Marlin and that resolves the plot?
No, that doesn't even make sense. Marlin's not her dad. Oh, God. Never mind.
Marlin does act like her dad in the movie, though, but that's another problem I had with them with Finding Dory. Is it sort of like, did they reset Marlin's character for this movie? But I don't know enough about Finding Nemo to say.
That was a funny joke.
It was. I mean, I will tell you off air what the fucking climax is.
No, that's fine. I'll wait. I'm gonna see it.
I just love seeing Ben Affleck's ass. Oh my God, I was not expecting it, and then I saw it and I was just like, what? Oh my God, glorious. And can we talk about the fabulous Jenna Malone?
I mean,
we just did.
Yeah, I mean, her role is so. I mean, I will always love Jenna Malone for that interview she did about Sucker Punch.
But we didn't talk about her enough, though. Like, I feel like we just kind of. I mean, she's just.
She's not really in the movie, though. Like,
but she's like the blonde hair and the glasses. I mean, it's just. Oh, my God.
Well, we are going to.
I want to see more of her.
We are going to do a Snyder series on this movie. So, ladies and gentlemen, you will get a full 1.5 hour analysis of this film.
Right.
Again. But this time more thematic analysis.
Yeah, not again. We haven't really analyzed it. We've just sort of given brief thoughts. Like, this is going to be, if you liked our Sucker Punch episode, our Man of Steel episode, you know, maybe we'll bring Christina Wren back. I don't know. We'll do a full
analysis.
Are we going
to have all four of us? James will be on too, maybe? And
maybe, we'll
all
see.
Kind of sitting back.
We'll see. Cool. All right, so we're running a little long here. So I say we cut the Reddit section. And let's just go.
Oh, no!
Oh, we want to talk about that threesome question. Come on.
I actually came up with answers for the threesome question. So let's just do that one.
Fine. No, we'll jump ahead. It's time for Reddit on Reddit.
Sony, stupid, Xbox, lame, PC, gaming all the way. EA Glow, Steam rocks, got Respawn on Firefox. These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, whoring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
All right, really quickly, each of these Reddits. Ready?
Okay.
First Reddit, when should you not speak your mind? I put this question in here because I have trouble with this, and it seems like Daniel has probably counseled Faisal on this a lot. So, Daniel, go.
very quickly, first, you should not speak your mind when Nazis are looking for Jews in the attic.
That's true.
That's an important one. Two, you don't have to speak your mind in any scenario where it could create negative or you could lose value. But even in those scenarios, I think you should. So like if a whole group of your coworkers is talking about how horrible, your favorite political candidate is, you don't have to go on a tirade against your political candidate. But if someone asks you your opinion, a simple like, you know, I disagree, but we don't need to talk about it. It completely suffices. And then two, and in legal situations, seriously, do not fucking speak your mind in situations that can be used against you in a court of law. Don't do it. Don't fucking do it.
Don't. Your Fifth Amendment rights, people. Do it.
Yeah. And my sort of response to this is similar to what you're saying. Context matters. And I think when we think of the phrase speak your mind, we think that means, you know, don't change your rhetoric based on the situation. But you can still speak your mind and not change and change your rhetoric based on the situation if you're doing it based on your values. Like Daniel's saying, the situation where you're not saying things in court because of your values and wanting to stay free, that is you speaking your mind. You're saying the best way for me to put forward my values is to not say anything. Well, that's your mind concluding that, right?
Right.
Yes.
So I think we just have a bad view of what it means to speak your mind.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, the people interpret it as being unfiltered and just kind of...
Right.
You know, my father calls it diarrhea of the mouth.
Right.
Where you're just speaking and your brain is not really connected. And right. In that context, if your mind is not actually connected to your mouth, then don't speak your mind because you literally cannot. Because if your brain is not, if your mind is not connected to what you're saying, then it's probably better to just not say anything at all.
All right, next Reddit. Life pro tip. If someone you know has a family member that dies, the best way to make them feel better is to act the same as usual. And my response to this is this a life pro tip on how to be an asshole?
Yeah, it seemed to me that there's something missing from this
context
here, because I don't quite get it. Like, you know, like your mom, you're like, let's say Fiza died and Justin just called me up and be like, I want to talk about the new Funko Pops. I'd be like, go fucking kill yourself. What? So I don't really get what the context here is. Like, I understand.
Do that now if when Fiza dies.
Oh God.
When we're like 80.
80 years old.
I would be like, oh, well,
that's not the new pop.
I got it on eBay.
Got it on Brain Bay. I thought about it and it came to my door. By the way, I'm dying way before Fiza. By the way, that's just how life is going to work.
Yeah, but women live longer than men, right? Because they fucking suck our souls out the whole life.
And not in a good way.
Sometimes in a good way.
But I think the best way is to, again, there is no universal best way. It really depends on you knowing your friend and what they need. So I know that some of my friends will need me to be active and talk to them and listen to them cry or whatever. But for friends who know me or in the situations that I've dealt with, I very much just want sort of like an acknowledgement, like, yeah, I'm here if you need me. But then I'm pretty much a solitary person in grief, almost entirely solitary. And I don't want interaction with other people. It makes it worse for me.
And sometimes things, you know, when you're grieving, things come off in ways that you don't expect. In our private message group, you know, I sent a screenshot of, I wouldn't say a mutual acquaintance, but I think somebody that we're all Facebook friends with. It was the Monday after the shooting here in Orlando, and he had posted something about what a great weekend he had and all these little things that he had done. And I remember just kind of being like, this is kind of thoughtless. This is kind of... You know, and so, and ordinarily it probably wouldn't bother me, but in just in that space and time, it was just kind of like, really, you're going to do this? So I think that context, it is a matter of context. There are some people who, like, I don't think I fancy myself as someone who's offended easily, but I think in that moment, I think I was a little like, really, you're going to say this? So I don't know. It is a contextual thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, why would you act the same as usual? Things are not the same as usual.
Right.
It seems like you're ignoring reality at that point. Am I wrong?
I think that's generally correct. Yes, absolutely. Maybe there's someone in your life who absolutely unequivocally needs you to act absolutely like you normally would, but I don't know. I think, not to psychologize, but maybe that might indicate something is very wrong with them.
Yeah, I don't think it's a question of acting normal. I think it's a question of acting you know, giving, helping somebody move forward, helping them process and move forward. So it's not necessarily normalcy, but probably, I guess the word I would use is stability. If that's, you know, just someone who can be a more, a stable presence, who can be your rock, you know, if you're going through a really hard time, that can help you to stand on your own feet and move forward. So maybe it's not really normalcy. It's more of that, that steadiness that you need, I guess is what he's saying.
All right, last Reddit. If you could have a threesome with any two people in the world, with the stipulations that their names had to rhyme, who would you choose? And I'm interested, Dan, who you came up with to rhyme with Fiza. Liza Minnelli?
I didn't pick Fiza. This was, since it's a hypothetical world anyway, I assumed a hypothetical world in which I'm not attached. So, thank you. Plus, honestly, I think Fiza would be okay if these people came along and wanted to have a threesome. But, I'm bad at this game, typically, this kind of thing.
Well,
but
it makes up for my brain fart this week, then, because I could not come up with an answer for this, which was part of why I was trying to...
You couldn't come with anyone?
I was trying to skip Reddit. Well, because I was like, okay, what rhymes with Mila Kunis?
I tried to find a rhyme with Kunis as well, but I couldn't.
See?
So the
first name or the last name?
Well, I rhymed last name, but you could do first name, although it's a little bit easier, I would say. So I came up with several, although two of them are jokes because they were just sort of the ones that first came to mind. So like literally, I just went like, what can I come up with off the top of my head without thinking about it? And I almost said out loud in the mall where I was picking up my glasses, Olivia Wilde and Julia Child. I was like,
get some cooking in.
Maybe in her younger days.
Oh, yes, of course, Daniel. Here's your souffle. And you must remember to grease the pan.
Oh, God.
And grease me, baby.
Yes, gives a whole new meaning to stuffing the pheasant. But
that's right.
So then another one I came up with was I really wanted to find someone to rhyme with Gal Gadot for the show. But the only person I could come up with was Margaret Cho.
Oh, man, that would be the dirtiest fucking sex ever. An Israeli and Margaret Cho? That has appeal to it.
And so,
I mean, you might get a lot of VDs from Margaret Cho, but...
So I actually updated it and thought, well, I could do a devil's threesome with Gal Gadot and Mike Rowe. That would be probably better than Margaret Cho. But then I actually came up with an actual
answer. What about Gal Gadot and Natasha Leggero?
Oh, that works. It's a tough rhyme, but it works. So the one I actually came up with, which was Jessica Chastain and Claire Danes.
They're very similar. Wouldn't you get confused?
I think when you're that far, it doesn't quite matter. Or Jessica Chastain and Lois Lane, if we could go with fake people. But
not bad. Yeah. Elliot, I take it you had an answer.
It's going to sound weird. I was going to say Stephen Amell and Robbie Amell, but that's cheating because number one, they're related, and number two, they are
really fucking weird.
Last name, it's not really a rhyme. Gosh. I've been toying with this because you know, when you think of two guys, like I can't really think of a lot of them that rhyme. You know, their names rhyme, so I have to think about it some more.
You people, I put in prep work for this week's show. I actually sat down and thought about women I would have a threesome with.
I did too, but none of them rhyme. So I was like,
"That's the thing." Like it's, and I did think about it. I was like, "Come on!" But I just could not bring it forward.
I mean, if that's prep work too, like I do a lot of prep work for the podcast. Then,
yes, I imagine you doing prep work at least two times a day.
When you're alone, you got to do what you got to do. All right. What did we learn this trip, Daniel?
I learned that I can actually like Tom Hanks in something, as long as he has a cool white mustache.
And he's directed by Clint Eastwood.
Oh, well, then, I mean, that helps.
Elliot?
I learned that I could be beat up by the FDA because I dare to eat raw cookie dough in my own house.
How dare you, you fucking criminal.
I know, right? Seriously.
Disgusting. You're so anti-American.
I'm a vigilante. Nazi, like Oliver Queen.
You just want to be like him.
You just want to be in him.
I want him.
Justin, what did you learn this week?
I learned that apparently I hate Mexicans and like Nazis.
Donald Trump, 2016.
Yeah, apparently I am now a Trump voter. Without realizing it, I am a Trump voter.
Oh, man.
Oh, God. Don't do
that. if you learned something this week other than you're a wild racist, why don't you tell us on the Twitters, twitter.com/TheMidSide, or facebook.com/TheMidSide, or what are you on, fucking Snapchat?
I am on Snapchat, and I would like to point out that I got a Snapchat follower this week because I promoted it last week, so how about that?
Wow, you increased your Snap following by like 100%?
What do you mean? I can get like 25 views per Snaps on my Snap story.
Oh my God. First Snapchat, then the world. Yeah, so there's also Instagram at the Midside. We're social media whores. We're pretty much everywhere. You can get all the back episodes of the Midside on our website, themidside.com, or is it themidside.com? Yeah, /podcast.
Yeah.
Also, you can subscribe on iTunes. Go to iTunes and type in Midside. You scroll past Welcome to Night Vale bullshit, and Welcome to the Beehive, and you click subscribe on our podcast, and you give us a 5-star rating. That's 5 fucking stars. 5 of them. 5-star footlong rating is what you give us.
Don't say
tell
that.
Us what you think of the show.
That makes the people think of pedophilia now.
Oh.
Right. Poor Jared.
Poor Jared?
He'll be missed.
No, and
then,
won't.
Of course, there is Patreon. Oh, how we love Patreon. Patreon is a site where you can go and you can subscribe to our content and you can choose to give us money for every piece of content that we do. We are incredibly thankful. Seriously, like, it still blows my mind that human beings give us actual money that they earn to do what we just did for an hour and a half. Which is excellent. We love you for that. So you can go to Patreon.
You guys are giving me money to defend the Nazi flag.
I know. probably going down this week, or we'll get a few more Deutschmarks. I'm not sure. Maybe we'll get some of that Nazi gold. We'll start giving us the Nazi gold.
The Nazi gold, that's the Jew gold they stole, isn't it?
Probably. Stolen Jew gold. You go to patreon.com/TheMidSide. You can choose to give us some money that helps us keep the lights on, and it helps us continue to do more of what you love, which is bitch about the things that you hate.
Yep.
So, thanks. We love you.
I'm Justin Mlesniewski, and I hope you learned something this trip. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.